Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The holiday season is upon us. So on this week's Louisiana Eats, we're going to get you ready to be the host or hostess with the mostest. No one knows how to throw a party quite like Julia Reed. Julia joins us to give us her very best advice for how to throw a party where you and the guests will all have a ball. Then, Rob Bigelow, Master Sommelier of St. Michelle Winery, broadens our libation horizons with cocktails crafted with wine. And we'll also get a lesson in rice craft from Sonoka Sakai. Her easy-to-make little rice balls will add a tremendous touch of whimsy to any holiday buffet. So without further ado, let's get the party started on this week's Louisiana Eats. No one knows how to eat, drink, and make merry, quite like Julia Reed. Born in the Mississippi Delta, Julia has written extensively about Southern food and hospitality for New York Times, Newsweek, and in her regular column in Garden & Gun magazine. In her book, But Mama Always Put Vodka in Her Sangria, Julia offers a number of stories from a lifetime of rollicking culinary escapades, along with some tips on how to throw the ultimate party. When we spoke with Julia, I began by asking her to share the story behind the book's scintillating title.
When my editor came up with that as the title, I thought, oh, Lord. I was telling him the story, and he said, that's got to be the title. And the story goes like this. I was still writing the food column in the New York Times Magazine, and I had gone to Spain and fallen instantly in love with the cuisine, and so I smuggled all this stuff out of there, and I wanted to come back and try to recreate some recipes, and I was going to write a column on Spanish food. Every time I did a column like that, I would test the recipes on my friends first, and so I called up my good friend Elizabeth McGee Cortez and said, I'm having a Spanish dinner party, and she's like, great! I'll bring Mama's sangria. She's got this great sangria recipe. And her mother was my mother's best friend, and we all grew up together in Mississippi. And anyway, so I'm like, fine. I had no real interest in sangria. I'm not even sure I'd ever made any, you know, whatever. I just sort of vaguely knew it was in it, which is like red wine and sometimes a little cognac and Grand Marnier and some fruit. So anyway, she brings these fruity-looking nice pitchers of sangria, and we put them on the table, and I put out some hors d'oeuvres. And I go in the kitchen, and I had not been in that kitchen like maybe 20 minutes to finish cooking. And I come outside and people are like making out with each other. I mean, it's like, you know, they're falling down in the bushes, like doing totally inappropriate things, talking too loud, you know, laughing too hard. And I'm like, Elizabeth, she was still standing. I said, Elizabeth, what in the world did you put in that sangria? And she's like, a liter of vodka.
The secret ingredient.
I know. And my mouth just fell open. And she's looking at me like I'm the one that was crazy. Like, of course she put a liter of vodka in the sangria. And so when I still didn't pick up my jaw off the floor, she said, well, Mama always put vodka in her sangria.
Well, you are a woman who can and has lived all sorts of places in the world. But you grew up in the Mississippi Delta.
I did.
And, you know, I have to say, reading about your life there, it really sounded like an inordinately fun place to grow up.
It was really fun. And part of the reason is because, I mean, you know, you're sitting around in the middle of the Mississippi Delta. There's not a whole lot to do all the time. Pretty much as soon as the place was settled, I mean, I found some diaries of people in the 1800s going to these like 4 and 5 day house parties and dancing. And, you know, the waters came up, so they're just raising the piano to the second floor and that kind of stuff. So it's there's still a little bit of that kind of mad abandon to entertaining down there.
Your mama and her friends, they really did know how to have a good time there. And so you grew up observing that, and then later became sort of a participating member of that coterie, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there was a lot of political change and stuff going on when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, and the Delta was sort of a safe haven. It was not quite as violent as the rest of the state, and mm-hmm. we had a great newspaper, Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper, you know, Hiding Carter, the second, who was originally from here, or from Hammond, wrote editorials that won him the Pulitzer Prize for preaching racial tolerance long before it was in vogue. And so we had a lot of people coming to town, and you have to give them a party.
Yeah,
that's when
course.
I decided I wanted to be a reporter, because every time a reporter came to town, they had a huge party for him. And, you know, he'd wake up off the floor in our living room, and I would be catching the school bus or something, and this guy would be sort of rearing his hungover head and writing, like, on the typewriter in those days, you know, Dateline Little Rock. And I'd be sort of smart aleck kid, like, aren't you supposed to be there?
Yeah.
He's like, shut up, kid. So I'm thinking, well, this is a great way to make a living.
Well, I have to say, the thing I think that was definitely the most intriguing and certainly shocked me was your chapter entitled Burger Heaven. Okay. If somebody had bet me $1 million who worked at McDonald's, you would have been dead last. Now, explain that.
I'm happy to hear that. I still have my polyester pantsuit with the zip front and the golden arches on it. I want you to
know. And you loved it.
Well, it was fun. I mean, okay, so what happened was, yes, okay, so I wrecked my mother's car.
Uh-huh.
And I was 14.
What comes of all that partying.
Yeah. You know? Well, it was the daytime. I was actually sober and, you know, I'm 14. But I was not as good at a driver as I thought, apparently. Anyway, so they're out of town. The first thing I try to do is fix the car. No avail. Plus, I didn't have any money. So I'm thinking, what can I do to, like, get maximum sympathy from my parents and make them almost forget that I've wrecked my mother's car that I shouldn't have been driving in the first place? So a classmate had told me that they were hiring underage kids at McDonald's. So there was a very nice, quote-unquote, manager there. I go down and get a job. It was totally unimpressive to my parents, who grounded me anyway. And now I'm, like, grounded, and I'm stuck working at McDonald's. But I started having a good time. I mean, it was sort of fun. we had a very hilarious night manager named Melvin, who ultimately absconded with the contents of the safe. But before he did that, he was a pretty heavy drinker. And he instructed us one night not to serve anybody Coke out of, like, that far-left Coke dispenser. And it turns out he hadn't found a novel way to make himself a bourbon and Coke. So he'd just be cruising through behind the counter. God only knows how many kids or teetotalers or whatever we got drunk accidentally. But that was it. That was the beginning of my career. And I still love a Big Mac, I'll have you know.
Well, as Southern as all your stories are, you just take everybody along with you on this whirlwind world tour that is the life of Julia Reed. We go to Paris, we go to London, we even cruise the Nile.
So, we go to Afghanistan. Right.
When was your first significant trip abroad, and what's your favorite place?
Oh, man, it's too hard to pick a favorite place, but my first trip abroad was to France, because I was dying to go, and I was still 14 when that happened, you know, on a study abroad thing. But when I started working for Newsweek and then for Vogue, you know, I'd go to places that, like I said, I would never have gone on my own. Like, you don't wake up and say, I think I'm going to take a vacation and go on the Trans-Siberian Railway across Russia.
But that's a pretty nifty assignment.
It was, but, well, no. I mean, there was no, like, shower on the train. It was pretty horrible. And I was going to some women's conference in China, and there were a bunch of German lesbians and French intellectuals, and it was just, you know, it's like, okay, here I am on the train.
On the train with them.
But it was kind of fun, you know, and they, you know, and then I didn't have the right visa, and they dumped me in a forest in Novosibirsk and had to make my way back to Moscow. And in retrospect, those are always the great trips.
Of course. Well, I loved the way you approached this book by dividing it into three sections, and those sections are eating, drinking and making merry. And of course, the book is filled with all of this very cosmopolitan elegance. And there's chapters entitled Of Paris and Pins, Men and Martinis, and of course, Champagne Charlotte. Mm. But then, Julia, you bring up this concoction called Yucca Flats. So, you know, let's leave Paris and let's leave the Pims and just take us to the Yucca Flats.
Well, as much as I do love a Pimm's Cup and a Pimm's Royale, especially in the Ritz Bar in Paris, I have an equally big fondness for a Yucca Flats just because I don't know what made me think about it. I was writing a column for Newsweek, and I started thinking of summer drinks and how it changes and everybody starts putting more fruity things and you switch from dark to light liquor. And it reminded me of the Yucca Flats that I drank at our neighbor's house where I learned all kind of important things in life, like how to play poker and how to hold my beer. And, you know, it was my first experience with all the boys in the neighborhood. Our neighbor had this huge big playroom and it had everything that you needed in life, like a pool table, a stereo, a poker table, and, an old couch. And in the summertime, the older boys would mix up a Yucca Flats in a trash can. So I started thinking, I wonder what was in there. I just remembered it being really delicious and like lots of squeezed lemons and limes floating around in there and some cherries and God only knows what else and a lot of ice. So I go online and I realize that like everybody's pretty much lived the same life because there are all these things online going, oh yeah, this is great to drink when you're having poker, or sometimes we mix it with our feet, and it's always in a garbage can. So I'm thinking this is like some international trend. The Yucca Flats, everybody had one at one point or another. Anyway, it's a delicious summer drink. So I sort of reimagined the recipe.
And it's quite a punch bowl. I mean, really.
It is. Well, a galvanized trash can can be very, very chic, I'll have you know. I have like this whole dream of having a big party, having nothing but huge garbage cans full of Yucca Flats.
That
to be
is
sort
really
of reverse chic,
party.
I'm telling you.
I love that idea.
Maybe I'll serve Big Macs alongside.
That'd be grand. Yeah, but just make sure that they're on a silver tray and there's a waiter.
Exactly.
We'll be right back with more outrageous talk with the outspoken Julia Reed. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill. From dock to pot, offering 9 varieties of fresh Gulf fish daily. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 115 Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. Our conversation with writer Julia Reed continues as we explore why the Mississippi Delta-born former New Yorker chooses to call New Orleans her home.
You know, when I was a kid in the Delta, we'd either go north to Memphis or south to New Orleans, depending on how much time we wanted to spend in the car. And New Orleans usually won. You know, it's like people sort of like, well, if we leave now, we can get to Galatoire's, you know, in time for dinner or whatever. I found out that the train from Greenville, Mississippi, my hometown, did not stop until you got to New Orleans. There was no point in going anywhere else in Mississippi. And it was a direct train.
That's
it was
fabulous.
Like the shuttle. So there's always been an affinity. I mean, you know, growing up. And then I came for Jazz Fest, and I heard myself saying at about 3 o'clock in the morning after a post-Jazz Fest party, oh, yeah, I'm getting an apartment here. And I thought, well, then I guess I should.
Yeah.
And I did.
Well, I'm glad you did. And in your opinion, what do you think is the worst mistake that nervous hostesses often make?
Trying too hard, I think. You know, thinking, ooh, I'm having company over and I got to make some really incredibly overwrought, fancy thing. And I went through that when I was a kid, and I was like the youngest person at Newsweek in the Washington Bureau. I did know how to cook because I, you know, grown up, as you said, watching my mother and her friends entertaining cooking. So I thought, well, I can impress them with, even though like they've actually have bylines and written books and stuff. I'm like, I can give a good dinner party. But instead of just sort of cooking a squash casserole or whatever, the first big dinner party I had, I was just drove my mother insane. And I'm calling her up on the phone, and it was during the advent of Nouvelle Cuisine. So in the New York Times in those days, there were all these fussy, complicated, but not actually very good sounding recipes. So I was driving Mama crazy on the phone in the days when long distance actually cost money.
Isn't that funny?
Do you think I should have this or this? And I'm going through all these recipes, and she finally just cut me off and said, why don't you just make something that tastes good? And it sounds silly, but it's not. I mean, I became a food writer entirely accidentally when I was still writing for Vogue, because I had a party for an editor there who was leaving, and it wasn't my usual crowd, but I had my usual menu, which was like biscuits with country ham on it and a big old bowl of crab meat maison like they make at Galatoire's.
That never fails, does
I know.
It?
Deviled eggs, which apparently nobody had ever seen before because they were like tracing the trays around. And these were in the days when in New York, you know, the most popular sort of cocktail party fare was stuff like dried out chicken saute on a stick, which is like so horrible. The next morning, this editor at the Times called me up and said, would you like to write about food? Because they'd never seen anything quite like a stuffed egg, apparently, or a ham biscuit.
Well, that was the best party ever then. Good. Congratulations. That was quite an accomplishment.
But I mean, it just goes to show you, you know, it's like it really is, you know, have some food that tastes good. I mean, I always, my go-to hors d'oeuvre is things like fried oysters. I mean, what's not to love?
Well, in all of this entertaining talk, and I know you give dinner parties, and oh, there's Thanksgiving talk in your book, and I have never submitted anybody to, nor have I been submitted to, what you refer to as table talk.
Oh, God.
Would you explain that table talk thing?
Well, that chapter is going to ensure that I'm never invited back to a New York dinner party again, which is okay. No, I remember the first time that happened to me. I was at a dinner table at this sort of very famous book agent's house, and her husband was a writer, and there were all these sort of hoity-toity folks there. I was sitting next to a federal judge and Kimba Wood, who had just been turned down as or had to withdraw from being Clinton's attorney general nominee because she had the typical sort of, she'd forgotten to pay her babysitter's taxes, that kind of stuff. But there are all these, you know, sort of tabloid names there. And at one point, you know, we were eating some not very delicious food, and the hostess goes, you know, ding, ding, ding on the glass and says, okay, table talk. And she actually used the term, and we had to go around the table saying what we each thought about, like, you know, I can't remember now, like the latest Supreme Court nominee or, you know, what's going on with the current immigration bill or blah, blah. And instead of having like a discussion about that, which would be okay, it was literally like going around, you know, it's like when you're a kid and you have to say what you're thankful for at the table or whatever.
Yeah.
And it gave all these pompous people, you know, sort of a soapbox to stand on and talk endlessly. And it was just sort of, you've got to be kidding me. And then, like, I mean, I was with a couple of good friends, and we hit the nearest bar and had to, like, drink ourselves into oblivion just to get over it. But, and then another time I was at a party, same thing happened, and this guy just come back from the Gaza Strip, and he starts talking about this. And my views on the subject were extremely different from his in the first place. But there was no chance of, like, having an argument with him because he never shut up.
Right.
You know, I'd rather be in a place where, right after the Gaza Strip evening, I had a party at my mother's beach house in Florida, and everybody got in this, like, this big political discussion. We started beating one friend of mine on the head with a loaf of bread and stuff. I mean, it was a lot more fun just to have a full-out, good-natured argument. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I just can't imagine anything worse than staged conversation.
No, contrived parties, not my cup of tea.
Scripted.
Either.
If you have to script your dinner party, you need some new friends.
I'll say. Julia Reed, author of But Mama Always Put Vodka in Her Sangria. Onigiri or bite-sized balls of rice are a popular Japanese food that can be shaped and decorated to look like animals, flowers, and a lot more. Author Sunoko Sakai's book, Ricecraft, focuses entirely on rice and how to make these creative treats, something that's great fun for children and grown-ups alike. Sunoko not only gave us a lesson in onigiri, but also shared her childhood memories of the important role rice has played in her life. Sunoko, tell us about onigiri, because it's not sushi, so it's something entirely different in a way.
Well, actually, it's not that different. Onigiri and sushi, like if you have been to enough sushi restaurants, I don't know if you've heard nigiri. Sushi, nigiri?
Yes.
That means to mold. Onigiri is the honorific. You just put the O in front of it, and it's called onigiri. But the similarities in the two foods is that they're both molded by hand. It's just rice molded by hand. One, onigiri is, for the most part, is not seasoned with rice vinegar, sugar, and salt the way sushi is, because the sushi rice is meant for preserving the fish that you put on top of it. But onigiri on the hand is basically there's a filling inside. It could be fish, it could be meat, it could be vegetables, or pickled vegetables, and you mold it into the shape of a ball or an oval, like a barrel, like you would a sushi, but a slightly bigger, or a pyramid, like a triangular shape, and you wrap it with nori, or you could eat it straight. But the rice is more substantial than the topping that you get. The rice is the star.
Well, you have some very special memories of your grandmother and how she made her onigiri and how that experience was for you. Tell us the story about your grandmother.
Yes. Well, my grandmother was born in 1902. I was actually born in New York, and we moved back to Japan and back to America. Also, I lived in Mexico. But after we lived in Mexico, we moved back to the town of Kamakura where she lived and lived next door to her. And there's five kids in our family, but I hung out with her a lot, especially in her kitchen, watching her cook. And one of the things she really took time was to make a good pot of rice. She rinsed the rice and let it soak. And while it was soaking, we would sit around the stove. She would cook the rice in a cast iron pot, and we would just wait. And that waiting period was not just, we didn't need to be patient because grandmother was very entertaining. She would tell us wonderful stories of the past, of her growing up in Japan in the early days. You know, just she was born in 1902, so a lot of things happened in Japan. A lot of restoration happened, and it was a time when Japan opened up its ports and became more westernized. So there was a lot of influx of things Western, and like eating a piece of steak, and that's something she talked about the first time she ate steak while we were waiting for this rice to cook. So that was kind of interesting, and I still remember that.
So then the rice is cooked. What happens then?
Well, the rice is cooked, and of course the first thing she does is she opens the lid, right? And you have to kind of let the lid sit for 10 minutes after the rice is cooked. And you know, there's just no peeking allowed while it's cooking. So when she finally says, okay, it's time to open the lid, this beautiful white steam comes out, and then it would fog her glasses. And then everything will clear up, and we see these beautiful pearly grains of rice inside the pot. And we would smell the beautiful aroma, this grassy aroma of the rice. And then she would start making onigiri for us. And often she liked to fill the onigiri with shaved bonito. And you just add a little soy sauce, and it makes for a really great filling called okaka for rice balls. And she would just stuff it and put a dab of salt on her palms and start molding it and then wrap it in nori and just hand it to us. And it was just so beautiful. Every bite tasted of something, you know, of my grandmother's love, of the Sea of Kamakura. We lived very close to the sea, so we would smell the sea and feel the breeze. And just that pastime was just so comforting. and delicious that I'll never forget that.
Well, there are so many different kinds of onigiri that you can make. If someone were to get started with this, walk us through what some of the more approachable ways and describe the actual method that you would go about making them.
Okay. So get some short grain or medium grain rice, right? And one cup of rice will make about three onigiri, three medium size. And when I say medium size, that's going to give you about three mouth bites. And once you have that fluffy rice ready to go, have a little teacup and just scoop some rice. I use about one cup makes three cups, so that three cups, you could like scoop one cup at a time or three quarters of a cup, put it into a bowl, and in the middle, make a little like a dent and put your favorite filling. And that could be last night's chicken or grilled salmon, flaked salmon, and put it in there. And have a little finger bowl, with water, and make sure your hands are clean, and dab some sea salt on your palm, just like, a quarter teaspoon. And then if your hands are slightly moist, then the grains won't stick to your hands, so then you could start molding it, and you mold it into the shape you like. Snowballs are the easiest, right, because it's just round. Any kid could do it. Like, I worked with, a four-year-old. They make the most beautiful onigiris. And if you feel like the rice is going to stick all over and you're going to make a mess, just line your bowl with some saran wrap, and then pick up the saran wrap and give it a twist, and then mold it like you were molding a balloon so that the rice is inside the wrap. And then undo the wrap and then give it a final mold with your slightly moistened hands. And then wrap it in a piece of nori if you like, or you could just eat it straight. But there are also plastic molds, onigiri molds, or wooden molds that you could buy online. So that's another easy way to do it if you are not sure about getting getting the shape right.
Well, I'm sure that this is something that is really, really fun to do with children. Children must love this activity.
Oh, my God. And they love to decorate it, too. So what I have done is I've done a lot of workshops, like at the farmer's market, at schools where they have, a farm-to-table program. I let the kids go and harvest their own herbs and little vegetables, and we'll just chop them up, red radishes and little pieces of parsley and nasturtium flowers, and they decorate their onigiri. And it's so pretty and fun, and even adults enjoy decorating.
Sunoko Sakai, author of Ricecraft. How do you avoid getting your guests too inebriated at your holiday party this year? Stay tuned. And we have some good advice for you about that when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally slow roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you avoid getting your guests too inebriated at your holiday party this year? First, have some non-alcoholic drink options, like a punch with no alcohol that alcohol could be added to at the guest's discretion. It would surprise you how many people will choose to drink the unspiked punch while appearing to party with the best of them. make sure there's ample water, both still and sparkling, easily accessible to guests. Making a habit of drinking a glass of water between each cocktail makes a huge difference in alcohol consumption. And for goodness sake, encourage designated drivers. And remember, there's always a safe ride home in a taxi. I'm Poppy Tooker, and I want your holiday season to be both a happy and a safe one. Wine and cocktails both have their place at a holiday party. But if you ask Master Sommelier Rob Bigelow, he'll tell you that you can have both all at the same time in the same glass. Rob specializes in creating festive cocktails that incorporate fine wines and unexpected flourishes. We invited Rob into our studio to help us design the ultimate wine cocktail list for our holiday party.
I'm Rob Bigelow. I'm a master sommelier. I work for St. Michel Wine Estates. I'm over all of education and on-premise development there. I've been in this role for 2 years. Before that, I did a 12-year hitch in Las Vegas, Nevada. I ran the wine program at a little motel out there in the desert called the Bellagio. And then I moved over to Open Aria Resort and Casino, where I opened as the wine director and then became the director of food and beverage.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about St. Michel, where it is, and what sort of wines they make?
We are St. Michel Wine Estates. The foundation of our entire existence is Chateau St. Michel in the great state of Washington. The chateau itself is in Woodinville, which is just outside of Seattle. We are Washington's first and founding winery. We have some other dynamic brands from there that you might know. 14 Hands, Columbia Crest, Spring Valley Vineyards, North Star, Col Solari. We also have a winery in California you might be familiar with called Stag's Leap Wine Cellars, iconic winery that produced the 1973 Stag's Leap SLV Cabernet Sauvignon that came first in the great Paris tasting of 1976.
So lots and lots of delicious choices.
All delicious.
But this using wine in cocktails, let's start with the very bottom. If you're going to make a cocktail using wine, how fine a wine are you going to select?
When it comes to making cocktails with spirits, if you use a low-grade spirit, you're going to have a mediocre cocktail. The same applies for wine. If you use a low-grade, low-quality wine, you're going to have an inferior wine cocktail. However, as you move up to the medium grade, same thing applies in spirits and wine. If you use a medium-grade, representative, good-tasting, well-made wine or well-made spirit in a cocktail, that's the sweet spot. You're gonna have a perfect cocktail, whether it be from wine or spirits. If you move up the ladder to the high end, you don't use high-end wines or high-end spirits to mix. Those are meant to be consumed neat and on their own. So right in the middle is where you need to be.
Well, let's get started. Mix us some virtual wine cocktails and explain why you'd use the ingredients and how to treat the whole finished product.
Well, like spirits, you need to strive for balance in a wine cocktail. So you're going to use wines that give you balance and flavor. And what is one of the great balancers in a cocktail? Acidity. Sweetness is also part of that triangle as well. So we search for wines like Riesling or Pinot Grigio that have natural acidity and maybe some sweetness in them that's going to help you build a balanced cocktail, because that's what the best taste is, balance. So we advocate for the use of Riesling. Some people use Chardonnay, but you want something with a little acidity. Some full-bodied, full-flavored red wines can make for very good cocktails.
Like which varietals would that be?
We saw a lot of people using Malbec.
Malbec.
Because it's got a lot of structure, but it's also got great aromatic capabilities and a wonderful fruit profile on the palate that helps build a great cocktail.
Wonderful. So mix me a drink.
Let's start with a new Riesling. This is a Washington State Riesling as our base. I might add a splash of Fernet Branca. I might also add like a quarter spoon of Mezcal or Scotch whiskey just for that smoky flavor. I would put just a splash of simple syrup. I might add a little lemon juice to get that balance, and I would include also something like a peach puree to offer some, to play off the peach aromas and flavors that would be in the Riesling, offer a little additional sweetness, broaden the palate, make for balance. I would shake that. I would serve it on the rocks. I would float a little more Riesling on the top, and maybe I'd put a little slice of white peach on as the garnish.
Well, that sounds beautiful. Okay, mix me a red one.
I'll mix you a red one. Let's use our Red Diamond Malbec. Malbec hails and comes from Argentina. So in using red wines in cocktails, you're not going to use 3 or 4 ounces of red wine because that's going to dominate everything else. Again, we're looking for balance. So I would build in a shaker some of the Red Diamond Malbec. I'd go back to the Scotch whiskey because I just love the, you know, something peaty and smoky, like, you know, just a little bit, because a little bit goes a long way. So maybe a little Laphroaig 18. I would muddle some blueberries into the mix because they're one of the fruit characteristics of Malbec is blue fruit. Blueberry, obviously, the boss of the blue fruits. I would muddle that, I would strain it, and I would top it with either a little club soda or maybe our Michelle Brut sparkling wine to give some effervescence to lift all of those blueberry and Scotch whiskey smoky flavors and to be sort of wrapped in a blanket by the great tastes of the Red Diamond Malbec.
Well, that just really sounds delicious to me. So these cocktails that we're virtually mixing here, are these before dinner cocktails? Are these cocktails you drink with dinner? And how would you treat a wine cocktail for after dinner?
Well, I think wine cocktails have their application across the board. The consumer trends show that nowadays, consumers are looking for lower alcohol cocktails, something to start your night with as an aperitif so that you can drink one or two and not be done with your alcohol consumption for the evening. Something lower in alcohol, light, refreshing. You know, the term aperitif applies across the board for any pre-dinner beverage, anything that's going to pique your appetite or begin, you know, be a social lubricant and make conversation flow at the beginning of the evening or at the beginning of the party. So you can certainly start with lighter, more white wine or sparkling wine-based cocktails to begin, but you can pair wine cocktails all the way up through the meal too and including dessert just as you would a wine. Obviously, as you build through to entree, et cetera, you're going to start to lean more toward the red wine-based cocktails, maybe to go with your red meat protein dish, whatever. You need something with red wine to stand to that. And then when you get to dessert, then you lean to something that has a little more sweetness to it, like a sweeter style Riesling, maybe again coming back with the sparkling wine or using a small measure of port to darken it up and bring it up and, you know, help finish the evening with something that has some sweetness and is going to help clean your palate and satisfy you at the end of your dinner.
Rob Bigelow, Master Sommelier at St. Michelle Wine Estates. I am satisfied.
I'm David Scott Solomonson. I'm the co-author of 12 Bottle Bar, which I wrote with my lovely wife here.
And I'm the lovely wife, Leslie Jacob Solomonson, also co-author that I wrote the book 12 Bottle Bar with my lovely husband.
Whether you're a cocktail connoisseur or just have a casual interest in mixed drinks, Leslie Jacob Solomonson and David Scott Solomonson would like you to get the most out of your cocktail experience. Their book, 12 Bottle Bar, offers hundreds of recipes, tips on how to throw your own cocktail party, and a new way to think about drinking.
There's two things I really want to achieve with this book and sort of with the mission we're on. One is to wipe light beer off the have people over to your house menu. If you ride a Harley and you drink light beer, we need to have a talk.
Because we want to go riding with them, right?
Correct. And well, the other thing is we really would like to, with the cocktail renaissance, the one thing we haven't really seen so much is the resurgence of the cocktail party. And we'd like to have people go, you know, it's not that difficult to make something like a Tom Collins punch. And you make it in advance of your party. And then your friends come over and they serve themselves. And you do what you're supposed to do, which is be with your friends and not being trying to impress them by, you know, how great you can make a blue blazer.
And one of the messages of the book truly is that cocktails are no mystery. Going to a bar is a very different experience than making drinks at home, either for yourself or for your friends. You go to a bar to treat yourself and to indulge, not only in ingredients that can be esoteric or can be something you might not normally try, you're not even sure how to handle it or mix with it, but you're excited and you want to see what a bartender can surprise you with. I think that's the new nature of the cocktail culture, and bartenders flourish when you give them that permission. But by the same token, you don't want to take that time to make things at home that are that complex. You want to make a well-made drink that you can customize and that has certain elements of whimsy, perhaps, or something like that. But being at home and drinking is a very different experience. In some ways, it's more intimate, and it's great for us. I mean, we can make a drink in 3 minutes in the kitchen, and it's fun, and, you know, oh, God, I squirted lemon in my eye. Oh, here, can you do this? Versus 20 minutes cooking dinner, even.
I can cook. You can cook. We can all cook. There's a big difference between saying we can cook and saying we're Grant Achatz or we're Thomas Keller. And I think that's the difference we see for the home bartender and the professional bartender. So from that perspective, and we like to use the food analogies a lot, is we really want to provide people with that great spaghetti and meatballs. We want to provide them with that great meatloaf or, you know, the fried chicken. So these staples that everybody feels comfortable, or everybody's got a dish they make. We want everybody to have a cocktail that they make. And I think one of the fears that most people have of cocktails is not understanding them. People go to a bar and they don't know what a Tom Collins is, and they don't really know what they want to drink. So they order something that they sound intelligent, you know, like I'll have a Grey Goose and soda. And they do it just out of panic and fear, I think, in a lot of cases, or just comfort. And I think if you get people to a point where they're like, you know, I like a whiskey sour, but I like it with rosemary syrup instead of regular simple syrup, and it's easy to make at home, and I can throw that together, that's where we want to help people get to.
So you think you might want to give home bartending a try? Where do you begin? Leslie and David explain how 12 Bottle Bar allows readers to acquaint themselves with their liquor cabinet using one bottle at a time.
We start with the one bottle bar. One is just pick a spirit you like. And quite frankly, I don't care if it's a spirit that's in the book or not, but mix it with some sugar, some citrus, go to town. Find ways to explore with different citruses, with different sugars, with a little bit of water. You know, make a Tom Collins, make a grog, make things like this that were the foundations of cocktails anyway. And I tend to like to follow that historic path. How did these things evolve over time? Well, let's evolve our education the same way.
And our bar. So if you're a complete neophyte, this is a way to sort of handhold you and say, drink what you like. You don't have to restrict yourself, even if it's not on our list, as David said, and you go with a basic. Then with the three bottle bar, we go to our next cocktail level where you can actually make a true mixed drink.
We add the vermouth and bitters at that point, what we call the salt and pepper. Again, food analogies for us. Bitters are more in the spice rack category, but we want to convey to people that things like the way you would add salt to a steak to bring, or to any meal, to bring out the flavors, you're not seasoning something to make it salty. You're not adding bitters to make something bitter per se. You're adding it to enhance the other flavors. So that's our three bottle bar. So your space spirit, pick a bottle of bitters, pick a vermouth that you like, make a Manhattan, make a martini, but just begin to learn how these things play together.
And
then
all in, if you were to do, say, those three bottles on the low end, you'd spend maybe $20. And you'd have your own little bar with your favorites.
20 to 40 based on what
you
buy.
Well, depending on how high end. If you have an expensive taste in whiskey, then yes, perhaps more. But if we're looking at the low end of our actual cost, because we do low end spirits and artisan spirits, yeah, $25, $30. And you've got your own little custom bar that you can make, you know, 20 or so drinks with.
And then we go to the four bottle bar, which is simply adding liqueur. And in the book, we basically specify orange liqueur. We like Cointreau above all others just because it's super, super bright and clean in its orange flavor. It's super clear, so it doesn't muddy other things. And again, to go back to food analogies, I think it was Stephen Reichlin or somebody who I learned from that when you make a rub, don't put salt in your rub. Add the salt separately so you can control the level of saltiness. And something like Cointreau, if you use brandy-based orange liqueurs or things with a lot of other flavors, well, they're going to bring all those flavors along with them. So again, a clean spirit or a clean flavor that you can apply specifically and surgically, that I like that.
Yeah, and Cointreau also is sugar-based, so that becomes a sweetener. And sugar is something that a lot of people are really afraid of because you think of cocktails and most people think, oh, it's spirit heavier, oh, it's bitter. But cocktails do, a great number of them need that element of sugar in them. And I don't mean a spoonful of sugar. I mean some sort of element that, again, brings everything into balance. You know, the ABV of the spirit, your actual percentages of alcohol, your citrus levels, which are your tartness, the sweetness of whatever sweetener you're using. So all of the things we have do that.
For me, a well-made cocktail is a war of ingredients that no side wins. You want that constant interplay. You want everything to come out. You want to taste the spirit. If you lose the spirit, what's the point in drinking it? If you lose the citrus or you lose the sugar, it should be sweet enough so it's not too sour. It should be sour enough so it's not too sweet.
Taste is exceedingly subjective. The drink I like is not the drink you like. It's not the drink any of us like because it's affected by memory. It's affected by what we've read. It's affected by our own taste buds.
The pretty girl you were drinking it next to.
That's right. Could have been the worst drink in the world, but boy, you remember that whatever it was, right?
And one thing we really wanted to do with the book is we had to find a way to make ourselves different. You know, the 12-bottle bar concept is, sure, that's one thing, but one goal we really had in putting the book together is we wanted to put a cocktail party in book form. So there's a linear path through the book. You read the chapters, the one bottle bar, three bottle bar. You read about the bottles and the drinks you can make. But we wanted this sort of parallel nonlinear path, which is if you're walking through a party, the conversations you might pick up. So, you know, we have people like Dale DeGroff and David Wondrich and a lot of, you know, up-and-coming bartenders as well. And then people like Mike Nelson from Mystery Science Theater telling about his days working at a TGI Fridays. And those are the kind of things I want somebody to be able to flip open the book, or we want somebody, and turn to a page and go, oh, there's something interesting to read here. So it's not just a recipe book. We want people to actually read it.
Well, I am so thrilled that you all took the time to talk with us on Louisiana Eats. You have really written a very special, very unusual book that I think everybody who drinks at home should have at home. So thank you.
We hope they think so. We enjoyed writing
it. Poppy, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Kind of you to say. Thank you.
Leslie Jacob Solomonson and David Scott Solomonson, authors of 12 Bottle Bar. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we examine the world of culinary collecting.
One of my favorite attributes of collectors is this overwhelming sense of guilt. They swear to themselves that if they just buy this one more thing, they'll never do it again.
On Thursday, January 12th, Louisiana Eats is teaming up with French Market Coffee for the first in a series of celebrity chef dinners to benefit the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Join us for an evening of fun and fine dining as Brennan's executive chef, Slade Rushing, prepares a three-course meal with wines paired by Bin 428. To see the menu and buy tickets, visit my website, poppytooker.com.
Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and from Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, a local New Orleans steakhouse serving prime beef in New Orleans French Quarter. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.